I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're going to spend the next 2 hours on the talks between President Trump and Russian officials in the Oval Office last week, the memo from former FBI Director James Comey concerning the firing of Michael Flynn, and President Trump's response, "I hope you can let this go." We have a lot to discuss in both areas during the course of the hour. The Republican chair of the House Oversight Committee, Jason Chaffetz, has demanded all documents related to conversations between Comey and the president be handed over. Vladimir Putin, of all people, has said that he'd be happy to release the tapes. That's rather ironic. There are some Democrats who are calling for impeachment, and today's Washington Post has a story that Congress is showing growing concern over Trump controversies. They're increasing pressure on the administration to produce documents related to the latest string of controversies involving the president. Amid flagging confidence in the White House and a growing sense that scandal is overtaking the presidency. We'll be welcoming phone calls for all of our guests, and we will have three of them during the course of the hour. We'll be starting with Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers foreign affairs and U.S. foreign policy. Later during the course of the 2 hours, we'll speak with a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico and also with a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Welcoming phone calls, I would imagine we'll have more than a few the next couple hours. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Uri is, as I said, a staff writer at The Atlantic. He has been global editor of The Atlantic and the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy. And his recent piece looks at the historical significance of the president's disclosure of classified information to Russian officials. We thank you so much for being with us, Uri. Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. If we could just go back just a moment. This news is happening so rapidly. It seems like it was ages ago that the foreign minister and the ambassador were in the Oval Office with Donald Trump. But, you know, I still have questions about why in the world the president scheduled such a meeting with the high-level Russian officials in the Oval Office with no American press. What was he trying to do?
Well, we do know from some reporting that Putin had been asking Donald Trump for this meeting for a long time. You may remember that Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, did a trip to Moscow, and he met with Putin, he met with the foreign minister, Sergey Lavrov, and so this was kind of a reciprocal event in which the foreign minister of Russia was meeting with the U.S. president. And Russia values these kinds of things. It shows that there's a reciprocal relationship. These are two great powers. They respect one another, and so Putin had been lobbying for it. What the mystery to me is not necessarily that this was a request of Russia, or that even that Trump granted it, but that they didn't cancel this after the day after Comey was fired. The optics on this were just really horrible, and my only way of making sense of it is that Trump didn't feel that he wanted to concede to his critics, that any kind of concession, any canceling of this meeting might get out, and then it would look like he was on his back heels when he was receiving criticism for the Comey firing. And if we've come to learn anything about Donald Trump, it is that he doesn't, when he's faced with controversy and criticism, he doesn't back away. He often leans into it and tries to hold his ground. And so that's my interpretation, but I will say it continues to be a mystery.
Mm-hmm. And then today, I mean, it's the irony of ironies. You have the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, oh, we'll be happy to give you the tapes of what happened there. The Russians will give us tapes of what happened?
Yeah, that is, you know, my colleague Julia Yaffe, who covers Russia as well, often says that Russia has been trolling the United States. They are just kind of, they seem to be messing with the United States and its current political moment in which there's so much divisiveness. And that comment was really a great example of that. I mean, he knows no one is going to take him seriously on this. If you had actually seen U.S. lawmakers on television today, a lot of them were asked about Putin's offer to provide the transcript of the Oval Office conversation. And they said, "Are you kidding me?" Mm-hmm. You know, Marco Rubio had a good line where he said, "If he sends it by email, I'm not clicking on the link." Well, there's no reason to trust Putin right now. And I think Putin knows that. And he is just kind of, you know, needling the U.S. right now because of its political controversy. He knows no one's going to really take him up on his offer. One thing that the Kremlin has said is, you know, there was speculation. Does that mean they have an audio recording of this conversation? And what the Kremlin has clarified is they claim to have a transcript, kind of written notes. But whatever it is, I don't think it's going to see the light of day because Congress is not going to take him up on it.
Right. In one of the pieces recently in The Atlantic, there was this sentence: Russians have been pressing for such a legitimizing visit for years. Since 2013, the Obama administration refused to give them one. Why? Why did the Obama administration refuse such a visit?
Well, initially, the Obama administration wanted better relations with Russia. And, you know, the thing that's become iconic of that is Hillary Clinton traveling to Moscow with a reset button and saying, we want a better relationship, and making it official with that kind of prop. But relations soured, as they often do. Every administration comes in since the Cold War, every U.S. administration, thinking they're going to improve relations with Russia, and there's almost always a falling out because these two countries just don't see eye to eye on a lot of major issues in international affairs. And the same thing happened with the Obama administration. Relations went downhill, and they primarily went downhill because of the 2014 annexation of Crimea by Russia and Russia's meddling in general in Ukraine. And as a result of that, the Obama administration imposed sanctions. The Europeans imposed sanctions. And Russia didn't back down on their annexation of Crimea or their efforts to influence the internal politics of Ukraine. As a result of that, Obama didn't want to legitimize Putin by allowing such a visit. This was an effort to isolate Russia, to isolate them economically with sanctions, and to isolate them diplomatically by not inviting them into the Oval Office. So already, just by allowing the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador into the Oval Office for a private, seemingly chummy meeting, Trump has made a policy statement. And that policy statement is, we don't think your annexation of Crimea and what you're doing in Syria, for example, is a serious enough threat to U.S. interests that we are not going to allow such meetings. Mm-hmm. So even though it seemed like maybe it was just a photo op, the Trump administration was making a larger statement there.
Mm-hmm. What about the evidence they meddled in America's 2016 election? Does Donald Trump still not believe that happened?
He's gone kind of quiet on that. In early parts of his administration, and certainly during the transition, he was very vehement, saying, you know, I don't believe this. This is just an effort by the Democrats to smear me. He still kind of says that the Russia controversy writ large is an effort by the Democrats to excuse their election loss and an
right.
effort to smear him. But he's kind of backed away from talking specifically at all about whether Russia interfered in the election. My sense of why that's the case is because, as we've seen so vividly this week, there's a really strained relationship between the White House, and particularly Donald Trump, and the intelligence communities, mm-hmm. FBI, CIA. And I think he has tried to back away from specifically casting doubt on the intelligence community's conclusion that Russia did indeed interfere in the election, because he doesn't want to further that mistrust between them. But obviously, if that's the case, it hasn't done much, because we've seen these splits very much on display this week.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we get the incredible news. It's one story after another that he revealed classified information at that meeting, which has broad ramifications and also may endanger the lives of people from Israeli intelligence who are the source of this information. And everybody's wondering why he would do this. Is it because he wants to say, hey, I've got a secret that I want to share with you guys, you're my friends? Is it because he doesn't get briefings, intelligence briefings? Is it because he doesn't understand how this may be problematic? It's hard to figure out why he would do that.
It is hard to figure out, and the answer depends on who you ask. So if you ask the Washington Post and their reporters, they will tell you, or at least if you read between the lines of what they're reporting, it would seem to be an off-the-cuff remark.
Mm-hmm.
So if you read that Washington Post story and similar stories that came out in other news outlets, this intelligence was divulged in the context of Trump saying, I get the best intel, I get great intel. And also immediately after him divulging this classified information about a potential ISIS terrorist plot, White House officials apparently scrambled to notify the CIA and the NSA and to say, hey, this came out in this meeting. You need to, you know, tell our partner that this happened, and let's try to mitigate the damage and not jeopardize this relationship. So if you read the reporting, it would seem to be an off-the-cuff remark that was made in kind of a fit of boasting. If you listen to Donald Trump, especially on Twitter, what he is saying is that he did this because he wants to partner with Russia and that he sees them as an important counterterrorism partner. And what better way to create a close partnership than to let them in on some really sensitive information, and specifically to let them in about information that involves plots on airplanes? Because if they're both tackling a terrorism threat, they should know what the latest threats are specifically. So that's Trump's explanation. If you listen to H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, he has been kind of dancing around what exactly happened, whether this was deliberate, which he suggested by saying, the Trump administration wants closer counterterrorism relationships with Russia, and they wanted to discuss common threats. But then he's also suggested that it was a little off the cuff. For example, he said that Trump didn't even know the source of this information, which is very strange because you would think he was briefed about this from intelligence officials and they would have included information on the source. But he made it seem to suggest that Trump was talking about information that he didn't really have a deep knowledge of. So McMaster has kind of been in the middle between saying that this was off the cuff and Donald Trump's version of the story, which is that this was a deliberate plan to bring the Russians closer on counterterrorism.
Mm-hmm. And can we be fighting terrorism partners with the Russians? Are we?
You know, it's a good question, because if you look at what has actually happened between the United States and Russia, we haven't seen much counterterrorism cooperation since the Trump administration began. You know, the whole raison d'etre, the whole rationale that Trump made for closer relations with Russia is that we both have a common enemy in ISIS and we need to fight it. If that's the case, we haven't seen much concrete developments that suggest that Russia and the United States are doing this, that the effort to get closer to Russia is really bearing fruit. For example, take Syria. In Syria, Russia has continued to not really crack down on ISIS or bomb ISIS. They are mainly, their main goal in Syria right now is to help the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The U.S.'s main goal in Syria is to defeat ISIS. And so we haven't really seen them come together. And I don't know exactly, you know, what cooperation would look like, and Donald Trump has not articulated that.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing I would say here is that Russia right now is very isolated from Western countries. They're isolated from Europe, European countries, isolated from the United States. For many, many years, their way of kind of doing outreach to the West is to say, let's cooperate on terrorism. And the reason they do that is because, you know, that's hard to argue with, right? Terrorism is bad. Cooperating on it is good. Even if you're angry with Russia for annexing Crimea or for its antagonism in other parts of the world with the U.S. interests, it's hard to say, no, we'd rather not cooperate with you on terrorism. It's a good way for Putin to ingratiate himself with Western leaders. But even he often says this, but Western leaders still have not often taken that kind of olive branch and turned it into close cooperation. So we've never seen from any real European or American leaders going so far as to, for example, creating a coalition to fight al-Qaeda or ISIS. We have not seen that happen, and we still have not seen that happen with the Trump administration, despite its rhetoric about wanting closer ties with Russia on terrorism.
Interesting. Israel made a statement yesterday seemed indicating that we're still very close with them, we're great allies. You would think, though, that they have to be fairly upset that this information came from their intelligence, which is very, very good, and there have been reports that Russia could determine how the information was collected, and this could somehow get to Iran, which is Russia's ally, and they hate Israel, and Israel hates them. What about the relationship with Israel? Does it make it more fragile?
I think, yeah, there is going to be some mutual distrust that comes from this. Now, there were actually concerns that reported in the Israeli press as early as January, so right when Donald Trump was taking office, where Israeli intelligence officials, usually anonymously, were telling media outlets that they were concerned about sharing classified information with Donald Trump. The reason they were concerned is primarily because Donald Trump had expressed a great interest in better relations with Russia. Russia has actually pretty good relationships with Israel at the moment. But the issue, as you mentioned, is that Russia is also closely allied with Iran, and Iran and Israel are basically arch enemies. And so there was concern that Trump, in his efforts to get closer to Russia, would share information that Russia could then convey to Iran, and that would put Israeli interests in danger. And those concerns, expressed as early as January, are now concretely being realized. Mm-hmm. And I think that we don't know if this is the first time. It's the first time that it has come to public knowledge. We don't know if this is the first time that Israel has felt that information has been leaked that they don't want to. And so I think this is only going to deepen Israeli suspicions about sharing information with the Trump White House. That being said, this relationship is much greater than just, you know, intelligence sharing. And I think that I don't see the fundamentals of the relationship being affected by this. I just see Israeli leaders being more circumspect about sharing information with Trump. And I also think that more broadly than that, there are many Israeli leaders, especially right-wing Israeli leaders, who are beginning to be a little disappointed with Donald Trump. Similar to actually what you're seeing in Russia, where they expected this to be a great relationship. You know, Trump talked tough on threats to Israel. He said that he was going to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which a lot of right-wing Israeli leaders want. He said he wouldn't criticize Israeli settlements, which a lot of right-wing Israeli leaders want. Trump has since backed away from that point about moving the embassy, and in general has kind of backed off some of his more hawkish statements regarding Israel's enemies. And so I think this Israeli right-wing leaders may be a little more disillusioned with Trump. I don't see the relationship as a whole being rocked a ton. This is a long-standing, decades-old relationship. I don't think one leak like this is going to change that.
Mm-hmm. And before we go to phone calls, I'm just interested in how the Russian media responded. I understand that it was prominently covered by the Kremlin media, this meeting with Trump and the foreign minister and the ambassador to the United States. How prominently covered, and were they gloating?
Yeah, so there were a lot of different reactions I thought were very interesting. One is that a foreign ministry spokesman went on Facebook and told all her followers, don't listen to what American newspapers have to say. And she was saying that in reference to the Washington Post story about the leak of classified information. She was like, there's no reason to believe U.S. newspapers, which
oh
is
gosh.
Kind of an echo
right.
of the fake news mantra and just in general a surprising statement for a government that controls a lot of media to say. But she was basically making the argument that there's nothing to believe here. One interesting thing that I saw in looking at the Russian media is that there was a lot of coverage of the meeting itself because, as you mentioned, this was a legitimizing effort for the Russian government. Say, the U.S. is reciprocating and bringing in our top diplomats just like we did theirs. We have a great relationship of mutual respect. But the Washington Post story was actually getting a little bit less coverage. And I think what was happening is people were downplaying these revelations of classified information being shared because they didn't want to concede that Donald Trump had done something, anything untoward with Russia. And so while this was getting attention, it was more, you know, don't look at this. This is just another effort by the U.S. media to undermine the Trump presidency. You know, everyone is out to get Donald Trump for wanting better relations with Russia. This is just, you know, a Red Scare. A new version of the Red Scare. So there was kind of more of an effort on Russian television, Russian newspapers to say, don't pay attention to this, mm-hmm. than to blow it out as big as they blew out the meeting itself. And so I think right now they just feel that the U.S. media and all of Trump's critics are out to get Trump and Russia and a flowering relationship between those two countries. And that was reflected in the media coverage.
Ari Friedman is our guest this hour. We're going to go to your phone calls and written messages as we continue. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers foreign affairs and U.S. foreign policy. And we're spending a whole 2 hours talking about James Comey and the Russian foreign minister and ambassador to the U.S. being in the Oval Office, the president of the United States sharing classified information that evidently came from Israel, putting the relationship between U.S. and our allies in some jeopardy, why the meeting took place the day after the director of the FBI, who was investigating the relationship of the Trump campaign with Russia. It's all pretty incredible that this meeting takes place the day after he fires the FBI director for this Russia thing. Well, we welcome your phone calls, your thoughts about all of this. We are taking calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. And we go to messages and phone calls. A caller from Oconomowoc asked this. In Trump's meetings with Russians, why is there no transcript from American sources? Why does Putin offer to give a transcript? Were there any American sources who would have had a record of what was going on there, Uri?
Yeah, we do have, from the reporting based on meeting, we know that there was a full transcript, or at least a transcript created by, you know, Trump's White House officials. We know this because, according to the reporting, there was an effort once Trump divulged this information, there was an effort to keep that full transcript to a select small number of U.S. officials, and then to have a condensed transcript have the part about the classified information stricken from that and circulated more widely. So we actually do know that there were note takers, American note takers, in the meeting who also have a transcript. So that's the other thing, is that, you know, Putin's promise to give a transcript isn't exactly necessary. The White House also has these transcripts, and if Congress really wanted, they could try to get them. Mm-hmm. There were no, you know, typically in these kinds of meetings, you have the principals, you have, you know, the president, the foreign minister, the ambassador, the president's aides, and you have certain people on both sides taking notes pretty diligently in order to, you know, be able to refer to them later on in figuring out next steps on that meeting. Beyond that, you know, there's right now a lot of speculation swirling about whether there are audio recordings, because Trump, in threatening James Comey after he was fired, said, you know, I hope there aren't tapes of our conversations, and that has led to a lot of speculation about whether there are audio recordings more broadly in the Oval Office during these kinds of meetings. We don't know yet, and, you know, Congress would have to try to get those tapes to be able to really tell whether that's happening. But we can say for sure that there were written notes from these meetings on both sides.
Mm-hmm. What is all this due to the president's first foreign trip? He's going to be going to Saudi Arabia, to Israel. I wonder if it'll be mentioned in Israel. I'm sure the Israeli press may ask him about some of this, to Italy and to Belgium. This cloud is just hanging over. It's not just a little cloud now. It's becoming this huge cloud over the White House. Is he able to conduct foreign affairs on a significant level going this Friday, considering all that's been happening the last week?
I think this is going to be very hard. I mean, he could not have worse timing for this trip. To leave, I mean, I guess maybe in some ways you want to leave Washington when everything is going crazy and you want to get out of it,
right,
for a little bit. But, I mean, think about the actual, like, human components of this, right? When you're think about when you're traveling and you go off to a vacation in Italy, you know, and you don't have Wi-Fi on your phone constantly and you're not checking everything. Not that the White House will have the ability to access the internet. But when you're traveling, you're kind of thrown off from the daily things. And
yes,
you're traveling in a, you know, small Air Force One compartment. You're moving from place to place. You're trying to make sure there are no gigantic gaffes on the trip, that he doesn't go speak about Islam in Saudi Arabia and say something incredibly inflammatory and it creates protests. You want to make sure those things don't happen, because that's terrible optics in addition to being bad foreign policy. When you're focused on a foreign trip, it's very hard to deal with problems back home. And you also lose track of the incremental developments on what's happening back home. So from a staffing perspective, I think this is going to be very difficult on the staff, especially if the staff is internally divided, for them to be able to contain the fallout from this while jetting around the world. And for Donald Trump, you know, what we know about him personally, he's kind of a homebody. He likes to be home in his various you know, estates where he goes on weekends, and at the White House he has a routine. And I think throwing him out of that too may create some real fireworks in terms of how he responds to these various allegations. Beyond that, think about it if you're also like a foreign leader. You're meeting Donald Trump at a time when you don't really have a sense of how vulnerable he is.
Right,
how,
that's true.
How, yeah, like if you're the Israeli prime minister, you are another foreign official trying to work out some policy issue in a meeting with Donald Trump, you don't really have a sense of his ability to focus on those policy issues right now, or his, you know, how entrenched he is right now in the office, because there's so much talk of instability. I think it'll be hard to come out of this foreign affairs trip with anything concrete. It will help that he is going to places like Israel, which is a strong ally, so hopefully he will be warmly received. But I think they're not going to get out of this what they probably had hoped to when they planned this foreign trip, at a time when, you know, there was not as much controversy swirling around the president.
How vulnerable do you think he is?
You know, I think that the latest week of revelations has enabled his critics to talk about words like impeachment in a way they did not before. I think that we are a long way away from that. Congressional Republicans certainly aren't joining the chorus on that. A lot of the revelations that have come out have been very fuzzy. You know, on the question of the latest revelation, which is that James Comey kept memos saying that Trump had asked him to kind of drop the Flynn investigation into Michael Flynn, his national security advisor. People are talking about obstruction of justice related to that. You know, these are tough, tangled legal questions that people don't have definitive answers to. And I think it is premature to say that this is just the floodgates are open for any kind of impeachment. But I will say that he is probably more vulnerable now based on these substantive revelations than he has been in any point since the beginning of his presidency. And I think more broadly than that, he is just this larger Russia story is assailing him from all sides. It's creating divisions within his staff. It's emboldening his critics. And it's also making some Republicans waver on their support for him. So I think his support base, other than the segment of the population that really strongly supports him, and they really do, in general, a lot of the different camps of critics are expanding and also seeing more ammunition against him, and so I think that he is vulnerable right now.
Gary in Fitchburg, our first caller. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I've been observing politics for over 50 years and seen a lot of things occur. Our government right now, the House, the Senate, the judiciary, and the presidency, is so divided against itself. Nothing is happening with regard to infrastructure. Trump came in with some good ideas to make America first and tone down our aggressive foreign policy, where we have, I think we have like 1,300 bases around the world, military bases. And I see no reason we should not have detente with Russia, with Iran, stop spending a good portion of our country's wealth on military, and start building high-speed trains, infrastructure, new electric grid. Come on. We do not have to be constantly at war around the world to fill the coffers of the military-industrial complex. Let's stop it.
Hurry.
I think that is a very good point, especially about the internal divisions getting in the way of Trump's agenda. I mean, it's hard to do America first when America itself is incredibly divided. There's no unified America. And I think that you see this actually, the point made about Russia is a good one, because I think there are a lot of really good policy reasons to have better relations with Russia. In general, when you have two gigantic nuclear powers, you don't want them to be antagonistic. You want them to have friendly relations. There's things we can cooperate on in the Arctic. We could try to put an end to the Syrian civil war. These are worthy goals. We can try to make sure Iran sticks to the nuclear agreement. These are actually very good goals, and I think Trump was right to push back against kind of the knee-jerk antagonism toward Russia. There are reasons why Russia is considered an adversary. You know, Exhibit A being what appears to have occurred during our election campaign, where they tried to interfere with our democratic process. That's a big issue. But there are also reasons to have good relations. And I think one thing you're seeing right now is that because of these stories and the inability of the White House to put them to rest, and also just because of the constant revelations about Russia, even if Donald Trump and his campaign did nothing untoward with the Russians during the election, if there was no collusion whatsoever, no cooperation, and this was merely Russia interfering in the election and happened to help Donald Trump, the fact that Trump has not been able to silence the story and has fanned the flames to a degree, and the fact that there's been so many efforts to derail investigation into this issue, makes any kind of cooperation with Russia really unfeasible. So just to give you one very colorful example, there was a big controversy during this Lavrov meeting in the Oval Office, where there was no U.S. media allowed into the Oval Office, but a Russian photographer was allowed in and released pictures of the meeting. And this got everyone speculating about what if Vladimir Putin planted equipment with this Russian photographer so that he could take pictures of the White House and gather of the Oval Office and gather intel. Now, listen, that's conceivable.
Sure.
But the fact that everyone was extremely concerned about it also speaks to a kind of, people are very primed right now to see Russia behind everything. Mm-hmm. And they are primed to see Russia as trying to interfere in any way it can, even when things might be innocuous. This might just be a guy with a camera, right? But the fact that it's become such a toxic issue means that any kind of rapprochement with Russia right now is really, really hard, even if Trump wanted to. And so I think it's right that these internal divisions and this controversy is making it very hard for Donald Trump to carry out his agenda.
Mm. Well, and Gary talked about infrastructure. We've got health care, et cetera. Is it conceivable that the Republicans in the House and the Senate can just carry on without very much advice or help in fashioning legislation from the White House? Can they just go on their own? Because if they can't, a lot's going to be stalled, I would think.
I think they want to try to coordinate as much as they can with the White House because they don't want big divisions to show in their legislative agenda. And we kind of saw that with the first effort at healthcare reform, that when there was division between the White House and the congressional Republicans, it didn't turn out so well. And so they want to be on a unified page. But I could see a situation in which Republicans start to feel that Donald Trump's poll numbers are going down, that he is just besieged on all sides by these Russia investigations.
Right.
Where they say, you know what, we don't know this guy's going to be an asset to us politically, and they start pursuing their own legislative agenda. Yeah, I could see that. I don't think we're there yet.
Thanks very much, Gary, for the call. Claude in Madison, hi.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a lot of comments and one question. The question is, how many terrorist attack from Al-Qaeda or ISIS has ever Russia experienced? How many? That's first. The second is, one president tried to sit on the table with Iran, and it was seen as a devilish, the most dumb thing to do. And everybody knows that Russia has never been a friend to any country, left alone America. Now we are pactizing with Russia, and it is okay. Everybody finds it okay.
Thanks very much, Claude, for the call. Uri.
I think on the question of whether Russia has experienced terrorist attacks, they have not so much from Al-Qaeda and ISIS, though with one very prominent example recently. There was actually an airplane filled mm-hmm. with Russian passengers that took off from Sharm el-Sheikh, which is a resort town in Egypt, and was shot down, and it was a suspected ISIS attack. So they have experienced terrorist attacks from ISIS. More broadly, Russia was worried about jihadist terrorism longer than the U.S. has really been to the same extent, in the sense that they were fighting an Islamist insurgency in Chechnya and the North Caucasus before 9/11. And actually, the first phone call to George W. Bush after 9/11 was from Vladimir Putin. And there was a brief period where they talked very seriously about working together on counterterrorism. In fact, fun fact, George W. Bush used to have daily intelligence briefings like any president, and he made a habit of inviting some foreign leaders who he wanted to be close with to these briefings and doing customized briefings. And he actually brought Vladimir Putin to one of his intelligence briefings to work him in on some of the counterterrorism intelligence he was getting. So just a data point to keep in mind when we think about Donald Trump and Sergey Lavrov in the Oval Office. This is not something that is entirely unprecedented.
Well, what kind of intelligence briefings is this president getting? Is he getting daily briefings? I've read that he gets a lot of pages, but he just wants bullet points all on one page. Some of this is pretty complicated. You need to read about it, don't you?
Yeah, so every president gets something called the Presidential Daily Briefing. It happens every day. Donald Trump is certainly getting that as well. The thing that changes is how the information is conveyed to presidents. So, for example, Barack Obama liked to read lots and lots of pages. He liked to do a lot of his homework, and he would mm-hmm. do it by himself. He would get the briefings, and he'd study it late into the evenings. That was his style. George W. Bush was more of a conversationalist. He liked to talk. He'd put the paper down and just talk to the briefer and have a back and forth, and that's how he learned. What we understand from Donald Trump is that he wants it kind of, it's anyone who works in business kind of knows this from doing business meetings. He wanted it kind of like a a one-pager, you know, a bullet-pointed one-pager. He apparently likes maps. He likes to look at maps and visuals. So that is how he is getting the information. In some ways, I don't see that as a problem. Like, I think everyone learns different. We all learn differently. And this is the way he likes to learn. You know, if you're a real estate developer, you probably often look at schematics and visuals and when you're getting your information and deciding what deal you want to do. The issue that I see is if you're condensing information and if the president doesn't necessarily think he needs a lot of intelligence, which we're seeing to a degree in some of Donald Trump's comments, saying expressing skepticism about some of the intelligence he receives, you worry about the depth of the knowledge that he is getting, the depth of the information that is conveyed to him and how he understands that. So, for example, H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, said this week, as I mentioned, that he did not know the source of the intelligence that he divulged to the Russians. If he doesn't know that source, he might not know that it's so sensitive. And I think that is my concern, is that in the way this information is being translated, things are being lost in the translation, and that could endanger national security or just endanger our ability to gather intelligence because it is not fully being conveyed to the president, or he is not fully drawing on that information when he has these kind of off-the-cuff impromptu remarks and conversations with other world leaders. Mm-hmm. So that is my concern. He is, though, getting a daily briefing. He is certainly, without a doubt, hearing from the intelligence community regularly.
Adam Schiff said, the Democratic chair of the House Intelligence Committee, "I have to hope that someone will counsel the president about just what it means to protect closely held information and why this is so dangerous, ultimately, to our national security. I would hope that the president would know that at some point, shouldn't he?"
Well, if you listen to his campaign rhetoric, he claims to have known it. You know, he was very hard on Hillary Clinton for using an email server that, according to him, was too loose in handling classified information. And he said many times that someone who can't handle our nation's secrets shouldn't be holding the highest office in the land. So he has claimed to know it in the past, certainly in attacking Hillary Clinton. I assume that he has a knowledge about what this classified information means and its import and the ability and the importance of keeping it secret. Where I think the breakdown happens is that I don't think, you know, there are different ways to read what happened with the Russians. There's a way to read it that he brazenly decided to disregard the classification system and wanted to share information with the Russians and didn't care, and or that even beyond that, that he has some kind of special relationship with the Russians that we don't totally understand and wanted to share with them. There's also a way to understand it that's much more innocuous than that, but still really concerning, which is just that he talks. He's a talker. He boasts, and he has these kind of informal interactions with people, and that is a very challenging thing to do when you're the president of the United States, guarding the most sensitive and top secret information in the land. That is very hard to have that kind of informal, style. Often when you watch these interactions, for example, between an American president and a Chinese leader, they are very formal. They are reading from note cards. They have practiced and gone over again and again everything they are saying. These are very staged affairs for the precise reason that you don't want to have something drop, that you don't want it to drop.
Sure.
And I think that is just not Donald Trump's style.
Yeah. Matt in Madison. Hi.
Hi. First, I'd like to congratulate or thank the guests for providing information without a lot of spin to it. I haven't heard that on almost any other radio station. There's always been a bias in the way the information is presented, so I congratulate you on that. Second, I'd like to know, does President Trump have the ability to decide what type of the legal ability to divulge information to partners that he wants? So if in Trump's mind he wants to foster a better relationship with Russia and he wants to work on counterterrorism, you know, maybe it's in his mind, this meeting where he said, you know, we have information that terrorists are in this area, you know, that can be shared information. And third, why aren't we upset about this information being leaked from the White House? How can you have an effective meeting with any foreign dignitary if you have to worry about the people on your staff running to the media saying, oh my gosh, they're talking about this?
Well, it would have been nice if media was in the room so we could have had our own reporting about what was done. Are you concerned about leaking here? And there have to be a whole lot of people. There were people running to the CIA and the FBI because of what was said there. So there are people who are troubled by what's happening in the room. But what about leaks? Does that concern you, Uri?
Yeah, I think those are great points. On the leaks question, yeah, it is concerning. Donald Trump focuses on this. I think sometimes he focuses on it too much because there are other issues going on. On the other hand, he's right to say that leaks can be concerning. They can be concerning because we have to. A president has to operate in a certain degree of secrecy in order to take on sensitive issues. You know, if you're dealing with how to handle a North Korean nuclear threat, you can't have that being plastered around the media all the time. And so they have to operate assuming that their staff is going to be able to keep really sensitive information. And I think one of the concerns, that some of these leaks are bringing out important information that the American public deserves to know. And that's how often really important information is brought out, is leaked through the press. And to totally shut that off would be, I think, concerning for our democracy. But there are leaks constantly. There are even leaks. You read stories that are about the White House having an issue with leaks and Trump trying to clamp down on it. And then you have five anonymous officials being quoted about the leak story. So there are leaks going on about the leaks. And I think this is concerning because it shows a White House that is very divided and an administration that is very divided, where there are pro and anti-Trump camps. That's not good for the functioning of our government. On the question of whether the president can just decide to declassify things, yes, the president can. The president is the overseer of our classification system. When the president says something, it is automatically declassified. He is the only government official who is, or he or she is the only government official who is able to do that. And I think, you know, the presidents have done that in the past. So just to give a couple historical examples, Ronald Reagan, when he was making the case for why he decided to bomb Libya in 1986, he released information in a speech to the American public saying, you know, we know that Libya was just involved in a bombing of a nightclub in Germany, in West Berlin, and we know this because we intercepted their messages. And he divulged that information. Richard Nixon also divulged information about reading Soviet and North Korean radars when he was trying to explain why he knew that the North Koreans had shot down a spy plane illegally, a U.S. spy plane. So presidents have done this in the past. Donald Trump has every right to, in an Oval Office meeting, decide that he wants to declassify something or share classified information.
But it wasn't his information. It was Israel's information.
Yeah. But it was still classified according to the U.S. System. So it was from his point of view, he did have the right to share that. But on the other hand, here's where I think it's an important point, a subtle point to make. If you're going to decide to do that, especially if it's not your own secrets, if it's another right. country's secrets and you're supposed to abide by that, you better have extraordinary reasons for doing that. You better think that sending this information and risking a U.S. partner's continued cooperation and also risking this information getting to an adversary is worth it. And Donald, I don't think the Trump administration has articulated to the American public yet why, if this was deliberate, why it was worth sharing this information. And if it wasn't deliberate, that's concerning, because you make these decisions about divulging classified information for very serious reasons. And
right.
if it was not serious, that's an issue.
You have to think about what you're doing here. Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic, covers foreign affairs and U.S. foreign policy, is our guest. We are going to continue on all these related topics for a full 2 hours today. Hour two of our program will speak with a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico and also with a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll talk more about the Comey memo, hour two of our show. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. And we're welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Mitch is our next caller. Hi, Mitch, from Milwaukee. Hi, Mitch, you there?
And I frequently call in, and I want to thank the speaker. A lot of my comments or questions I was going to ask have been touched on. So I guess the one area I'd like to have the speaker talk about is the duplicitousness of mainly to the right party, especially people like our Paul Ryan, who have been just sitting on their hands and just letting Trump go carte blanche. So if you could discuss some of the ramifications of this and what's going to happen, and that we could truly be bipartisan on this effort of what's happened with Comey and Russia and emails, et cetera. I'm involved with Indivisible, and I'm a middle-of-the-road independent, but I'm just really concerned with all of the things that we've been hearing about swirling around Washington.
Thanks, Mitch, for your call. Hurry.
Yeah, I think Mitch is right to point out that the people to watch right now are congressional Republicans and Republicans in general. That's where the real significance of what these fallout mean is going to be on evidence, because the question is whether they continue to, you know, vociferously defend the president or whether they change their tone. And I would say that subtly, Republicans have been changing their tone over the last couple of days. It's not very obvious, but for example, they seem to have sprung into a kind of a an information gathering mode. So Paul Ryan today said, we need to find out information about Russia. He recommended doing it at the committee level, congressional committee level. But he said that we need to track down the facts no matter who is in the Oval Office, whether it's our party or another party. And that was a change in tone and rhetoric. Beyond that, there have been calls to get the records of James Comey's memos about his conversations with Donald Trump that the FBI has, and congressional Republicans on various committees have been asking for those documents today. So it's not a mode of saying, you know, Donald Trump is endangering American democracy and this is really serious issues. They're not escalating the rhetoric like that, but they've kind of shifted into a information gathering mode, whereas before they were questioning the value or logic of gathering the information, or not everyone, but many Republicans were, because they felt it was a witch hunt against Donald Trump and that the real issue were leaks. You know, that was the kind of stance before. And so I think that we may see them trying to track down more information. And the answer is we don't know where that's going to lead. It could lead to us learning that there was really no collusion with the Russians and that Trump really didn't dramatically try to interfere in this process. But we could also learn other things. And so I think that is where the debate is going to go, and we don't know yet what kind of information it'll yield.
Well, we already know Michael Flynn was fired because of what was going on with the Russians with him as well. Let's talk just a moment about the Russians here. I'm wondering how that plays into Republicans' thoughts about this, because for a long time, many of us lived through a Cold War in this country, and there are a lot of Republicans who consider Russia not to be a country to be embraced and come into the Oval Office. There are still some Republicans who are very concerned about Russia and very concerned about what they're doing to try to disrupt our elections, other people's elections, what they do to journalists, that they're thugs. Somebody today, a Republican from Illinois, Representative Adam Kinzinger, was quoted as saying, I don't talk to murderous dictators like Vladimir Putin, so Putin's word doesn't mean a whole lot to me. The Republicans have to deal with that issue, don't they?
They definitely do, and Donald Trump is extremely unique among Republicans in having such a friendly stance toward Russia. There are a few others, but most Republicans are very concerned about Russia, see it as a great threat. I mean, if you remember, Mitt Romney called it the greatest geopolitical threat to the United States, and he was mocked for that. It turned out to be a very prescient remark. So there are a lot of Republicans who are very concerned. John McCain and Lindsey Graham are at the forefront of that. I don't think what we've been seeing is that the Republicans have not dismissed these concerns about Russia on the grounds that Russia shouldn't be considered a threat, that they didn't interfere in the election. Generally, the way that they've opposed some of these probes is to say that there's no there, that there's not a lot of substance to these accusations, and that Trump's critics are leaping on them in order to try to, discredit a president they don't agree with.
Right.
So that's usually been the line of argument. It hasn't been Russia is not a threat. They haven't gone there because almost all of them don't believe it. And what we've actually seen, interesting in terms of the party dynamics, is that because the Democrats are in opposition, they've been the ones in the last few months who've been much more hawkish against Russia than the Republicans have. The Republicans just don't talk about it all that often. Although some, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, have been very vocal, but most haven't. And the Democrats are the ones that are constantly sounding the alarm. So we've kind of seen a party realignment to a degree in terms of the level of rhetoric against Russia.
Yeah. Let's take one more call. Just a quick comment. We're almost out of time, but I didn't want to miss you. Phyllis, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to disagree with a comment that someone made earlier that Trump was just trying to stop spending for the industrial-military complex so, you know, we wouldn't get in a war with Russia. But if you look at his proposed budget, he has made the biggest increase in the proposed spending for the industrial-military complex. I don't listen to what any politician has to say. I watch what they do.
Thank you very much for the call, Phyllis. And on that note, we have to say goodbye to everybody for this hour. Uri, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, a pleasure to have you here. Uri Friedman, a staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers foreign affairs and U.S. policy. We're going to be continuing our conversation on all of these subjects, hour two of our program, with a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is concerned about international security issues, and also will speak with the foreign affairs correspondent at Politico and be welcoming more of your phone calls. We'll talk more about James Comey's memo concerning, well, you know, it's all concerning, and we'll continue with this Russia story and the meeting with a foreign ambassador and minister coming up after we hear all the latest news, and that's coming up now. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour.